Everybody has their little mannerisms, especially public speakers. You know what I mean? Okay? And Jesus had his. There were a couple of kind of signature phrases that kind of you know it's Jesus. One of them is something that if you sometimes just take your Bible and circle how many times he says this. It's almost as if he can't begin a parable or a story or anything without this little phrase. King James, which is 400th anniversary in a couple of years. Verily, verily, I say unto thee. And more contemporary language, I tell you the truth. I tell you the truth. Circle how many times it says, I tell you the truth. I tell you, just your Bible just becomes emblazoned in all these circles. I tell you the truth. I tell you the truth. Here's another one. You have heard it said. Then what? But I say. How many of you like seaweed? Okay. How many of you eat seaweed? How many of you have ever eaten seaweed? How many of you have never eaten seaweed? Okay, you eat seaweed every day of your life. Ice cream, yogurt, cottage cheese, chocolate milk, pudding, ketchup, marshmallows. You brush your teeth every day? You say, well, I use Tom's of Maine. Seaweed. You look at the little carton, and it's called carrageenan. C-A-R-R-A-G-E-E-N-A-N. Comes from red seaweed. Uses it as a thickener, emulsifier. In fact, when your plane gets de-iced, it's seaweed. It's carrageenan that does the de-icing. It's also what they use to stick the Bud label to a beer bottle, but that's another story. Anyone here ever nod off while you're driving? Just for a second. They call these microsleeps. And actually, a microsleep is 4 seconds. Or, let me put it another way, the distance of a football field. You have just driven in your sleep, unconscious, down the highway, barreling at whatever mileage you're going, a football field. Let me try again. We've been hearing a lot about $1 billion and even a trillion, but let's just do a billion. We have 6 billion people on this planet. We talk about 2 billion, the bottom billion, and then 2 billion, the top billion. But let's put a billion into perspective. 1 billion seconds ago, the Beatles performed on the Ed Sullivan Show. 1 billion minutes ago, Jesus was alive. 1 billion hours ago, we were living in the Stone Age. 1 billion days ago, you didn't have anybody walking on the planet. $1 billion ago, it was only 8 hours and 20 minutes. That's the rate our government is spending our money, which does not include spending for the Iraq War, and it does not include before the meltdown on Wall Street. 1 billion Coca-Cola's ago was yesterday morning. 1 billion Coca-Colas. Now, all I'm doing here, you have heard it said, and then I'm putting it in a new perspective. Can we go to... Mike, his name is Chris Jordan. This is an artist that's trying to put our numbers to image. And this is his art form. And his name is Chris Jordan. And you can all go to it. It's called chrisjordan.com. And all he's trying to do is to, as he calls it, run the numbers. And especially run the numbers of what these things that we talk about look like. So this is, just stop right here. Can you go down a little bit so we can read what the, just so we can read what the caption is? Well, let's do this one. Okay, yeah, just there you go. To fix 100 million toothpicks equal to the number of trees cut in the U.S. yearly to make the paper for junk mail. So he has a image, each tree a toothpick. Well, let's go down to the next one. This is 1 million plastic cups, the number used on airline flights in the U.S. every 6 hours. Now, you got to go down because then you'll see it in as it gets bigger. And you go down and you'll see it. You zoom in a little more and you can start to see the cups. And then zoom in a little more. This is 32,000. Go down a little bit. No, you're supposed to. No, you're going the wrong way. Let's see what's the heading here. Don, we're not easily offended here, right? This is not a Baptist group. This, the 32,000 Barbies equal the number of elective breast augmentation surgeries performed monthly. This is just monthly. So they've just got, he's just got, these are the 32,000 Barbies. Now you can keep going down. That's why sometimes when you use VJ, you need a shutter. You know what I mean? Because a lot of people are easily offended. There you go. 32,000 of these. The next one is one of my favorites. This is one he's most famous for. 2 million plastic beverage bottles, the number used in the U.S. every 5 minutes. So go down, and then he just zooms in a little more. Zooms in a little more. 5 minutes. Just do one more here. The 83,000 Abu Ghraib prison photographs equal the number of people who have been arrested and held at these U.S. detention facilities. And so then he just zooms in a little more and a little more. Now, all we're doing here is making the familiar fresh. And my thesis for this afternoon is this is the key to effective communication. This is the one that he's, second one he's most famous for is the skull one. Can you just go down? Yeah. This is the 250,000 packs of cigarettes equal the number of U.S. Americans who die from cigarette smoking every 6 months. So he's just taken these covers. You can see as he goes down here, and you can see the actual cigarette covers that he's used. This is, again, 6 months of killings. All you're doing here is just making the familiar fresh because you don't know the familiar. In other words, I want to suggest that you all are in the making it strange business. Your job is not to make the familiar familiar. Your job is to make the familiar strange. There's a one-frame cartoon, two little boys, one holding a book and looking at the other. What does the word ubiquitous mean? I've been seeing it everywhere lately. One of the challenges we have in our church is that we are overly familiar. And I don't mean that in a good way. Ministry, our churches have a familiar feel. We repeat the fashionable phrases. We've got to hear the politically correct slogans. And everything has become so familiar. It's cozy and it's not fresh anymore. I think you all are on a, need to be, your mission is to be on a campaign against cliché. Clichés of the mind, clichés of the heart, clichés of the soul. And the opposite of cliché is strangeness, freshness, energy. In other words, your job is to make it strange. Now, as a literary device, this has a name. It was thought up by the Russians. It's a whole school of Russian thought. And let me give you the Russian word for it. Ostraneni, O-S-T-R-A-N-E-N-I-E. That's a Russian word. Ostraneni means defamiliarization. A good novelist, a good writer, any good communicator is skilled at ostraneni, defamiliarizing, overcoming the deadening effects of habits by representing familiar things in unfamiliar ways. Remember Emily Dickinson said, you all probably know this one, tell the truth, but tell it, anybody? Slant. Exactly. Tell it slant. Because in making it strange, you make it fresh. This is why I think poetry is so effective, at least for me. I love it so much, because it distorts the ordinary. It's a slippage towards strangeness. And it's only in that strangeness that there is fresh life and fresh power. And this is why metaphors are so powerful. Now, I'm basically going to spend this afternoon talking about metaphors for a bunch of reasons, but one is that this is a culture that the currency of a Google culture is no longer words, it's images. Advertisers don't spend billions of dollars a year to give you words. The only place left still trying to talk to this culture in words is the church. Everybody else has figured out that words no longer communicate and connect. It is a culture of image, where the currency is image. Mission statements. I know one church in our tribe spent 2 years working on its mission statement. Because we love to, quote, perfect the document. Notice how Gutenberg this sounds. And we love to play with words. These words, first of all, I don't get this to begin with. Didn't Jesus give us a mission statement? So why do we need to come up with our own? The mission statement he gave us is what? Go on the world, make disciples. See, now I know why we got to come up with our own, because we don't like the one we got. Because every mission statement is not a mission statement, it's an attraction statement. How do you get more people to come to church, not how do you send better disciples out of the church? So now I know why we got to have our own mission statement, because we don't like the one we got. But even if you then are going to come up with an attraction statement, then why, if you want to convey it in a culture that is there today, a Google world, why is it in words? Why are you not coming up with an image statement? Where's your mission image? Not your mission words, but your mission image. Because it's not the words that connect with the culture. And this is the function of metaphors. They make strange. They make strange our expectations. They link things. They intuit. They institute relationships. That's their power, as they link things that are not normally brought together. Freud. Freud has an influence today, even though Freudian theory has been totally discredited. There's nothing left about Freudian theory that has any credibility among anybody. But even though his orthodoxy has been discredited, he is still powerful because it's his metaphors, the ego, superego, the Freudian slip. That's the one that maybe we know the most. I have a secret mission in life, and that is to raise up a mafia of the metaphor. I call it my mafioso mission. Now, the godfather of the mafia metaphor, or metaphor mafia, C.S. Lewis, he did not start with words for the Tales of Narnia. He started with images and then trusted the words to come once he had the images. But the real, real godfather, capital G, of the metaphor, mafia, is Jesus. What prevents real change from happening in the church, in our tribe? But the four horsemen of the apocalypse, inertia, that's one, static is satanic, fear, impatience, self-deception. I think inertia kicks the hardest. Our real problem is less learning new behaviors as it is letting go of old ones. And cognitive scientists like George Lakoff, L-A-K-O-F-F, some say George Lakoff, have proven that to overcome the inertia of old patterns, we need new frames. Now, that's a technical word now. New mental pictures or metaphors that can redefine how we perceive reality. To change how we live, we have to change our frames. We have to reframe. In other words, we have to make the familiar strange. Just like you need to format your disc, you need to format your brain. And that's where metaphors come in. They reframe. George Lakoff has done incredible work. It's not just him. Eleanor Roche, R-O-S-C-H, Mark Johnson. These are cognitive neurolinguistic people. And they are basically trying to figure out how does the brain work when you try and change people's minds. You want to change their behavior, change their attitudes. What happens in the brain and what needs to happen in the brain? And fundamentally, what these cognitive neurolinguistic people have discovered is that if you want transformation to occur, you have to reframe the brain, the mind, with a new metaphor. In other words, your mind is made of metaphors. You say, no, it's not. Words. My mind is words. I think in words, okay? What do you dream in? You dream in words? Your mind is made of metaphors. The most elementary and elemental way of thinking and way of processing information is through metaphors. Words come out of metaphors. Hence, the need to use metaphors in the right way. And the real godfather, capital G, of the metaphor mafia is Jesus. Jesus is without peer in history for reframing. In fact, Jesus reframed the whole, in many ways, he reframed Judaism. That's what his business was, just to reframe Judaism, give it new metaphors, give it a new way of thinking. He reframed the Hebrew conception of the Shema, or the Shema, with perceptions of, with images. Forgive 70 times 7. Turn the other cheek. Walk the second mile. Love your enemies. Now, as befits a book culture, we Gutenbergers learned how to parse and exegete words. But in this Google world, the primary cultural currency is image and metaphor. And, as I said, metaphors are primary and primal biologically as well as socially. In fact, Martin Luther didn't like dreams for precisely this reason. He said that they were all images, no words. And they were sired by Satan because he was trying to get the church to claim what? Words as part of a print culture. So he said, don't trust those images. So all those, that iconography is going to lead you astray. But the natural language of the brain is metaphor, which explains why creative children register more dream activity than non-creative children. When you rearrange metaphors in people's minds, when you reframe, let's call it accurately what you're doing, brain surgery. When you are getting people, you have heard it said, but I say. You've been trained to think one way, but here's a reframe. You're doing brain surgery. Jesus' whole ministry can be seen as metaphor surgery, which is soul surgery, replacing one way of looking at God and the world with whole new mental models. And once Jesus said, "You have heard it said, but I say," what came next was, that was one of his favorite segues, "You've heard it said, but I say." What came next was a new frame that was often an upsetting, unsettling image, metaphor, that was designed to shake things up. And we wonder why rabbinic Judaism and the Jesus movement parted company. I was with a group not too long ago. This is before the meltdown. These were all the major denominations had their investment managers there. So at that time, there may have been hundreds of billions of dollars in that room. I don't know what was in that room now, but so I was trying to communicate a little bit about this nature of this Google culture. And one of the things I said, "And how do you think Jesus communicated? Was this the Jesus method of communication? Okay, let me give you these 7 habits of highly effective discipleship. Write these down." And I looked out there as all of them, guess what? Got their pencils and started to write down. I said, no, that's exactly how we did not communicate. Now, these are left-brain people, okay? So you want investment managers to be left-brain people. So I wasn't all that upset. But that is not how he communicated. I teach a course in preaching. In first class, I call it postmodern preaching. But first class, I say, "Who's the greatest communicator who ever lived?" They all say, "Jesus." I say, "No, you don't believe that. You tell me who you really think is the greatest communicator who ever lived." Then they come back and they say, "Jesus." I say, no, I want you to be honest with me. I want you to tell me, really, who do you consider the greatest communicator who ever lived? And they still say, "Jesus." I said, "No, you don't. Because not one of you is preaching like he preached. You're preaching like somebody else. So you tell me, whoever you're preaching like is who you think is the greatest communicator who ever lived." Because the greatest communicator who ever lived, this was his method of communication. "The kingdom of heaven is like," and then came what? An image, a metaphor, around which he wrapped a little narrative. A 2 to 3 minute narrative, not a 20 to 30 minute narrative. "The kingdom of heaven is like a lost coin," 2 to 3 minutes. "Kingdom of heaven," loops out of that one. "Kingdom of heaven is like a lost sheep," 2 to 3 minutes. Loops out of that one. "Kingdom of heaven is like," just stats on top of it, another one. "Kingdom of heaven is like a lost son." Greatest short story that ever lived. By the way, this is exactly the way in which you watch 24. Or any other television program. You're only in one narrative for no more than 2 or 3 minutes. Then you loop out of it and stack on top of it another one. And loop out of it and stack on top of another one. And often they help you know when you're going through major shifts, because they do that. That ding, you know, that 24 sound, that signature sound. Philosopher Nelson Goodman says that images are more than world mirroring, they are ways of world making. And I really believe that metaphors have that power. They had the power to create a whole new movement that we're part of today called Christianity, even though Jesus did not come to found the Christian religion. You all know that, right? We talk about Jesus helping us to become a new kind of Christian. If anything, he helped us become a new kind of Jew. Christianity is what we did to the Jesus movement. If anything, it was a new kind of human. That's why I don't talk so much about spiritual development as human development. But this is the power of metaphor. So let me, in this little bit of time that we have, suggest to you some metaphors that can change the 21st century. I don't know how many of y'all will have time for. I have 7. I could have 10. We'll probably get to 3. We'll see how many we have. These are also the metaphors that are out there. And in your story catching, rainbow trapping, metaphor mapping ministries, to present to the church these stories in a metaphor form. So here's number one. The apple. A Gutenberg world, by and large, even though we still had the tradition of bringing an apple to a teacher, we should have been bringing them oranges. Because the Gutenberg world privileged the orange, not the apple. By and large, the Gutenberg world didn't like the apple. In fact, everything the Gutenberg world touched, it turned into an orange. See, you don't eat an orange whole. You eat an apple whole, but you don't eat an orange until you what? Take it apart. You peel it first, and you take it, and each one of those is neatly sliced and diced and segmented and siloed and separated. And sometimes people don't like the skin, so they even do more, and they peel off the skin just to get the meat of it, especially if it's a grapefruit, a big orange. No. The Gutenberg world, Enlightenment culture, turned everything it touched into an orange. Whether it was a body of knowledge or the Bible, the orange privileged the critical method of slice. You got to save me that one. Of slice and dice. In an orange world, to verify is to versify. In fact, I grew up, I'm a slow learner, so it didn't hit me until not too long ago that my mother had us memorizing Bible verses. We had to memorize 12 Bible verses a week for 12 weeks, then we had 12 weeks off, and we had 12 weeks again, and we had to, each one was organized according to 1 week, the theme was hope, 12 Bible verses on hope. A couple weeks later, next week would be on heaven, 12 Bible verses, happiness, 12 Bible verses. Over the years, I learned a lot of Bible verses. In fact, I have an acute case of versitis. That really hit me. The Bible wasn't written in verses. That's what we did to the Bible. And we did it King James. Soon as we got a hold of that scripture, in the Gutenberg mindset, we had to do chapter and verse. We had to turn it into an orange. And then all of a sudden, as I was thinking about this, I'm going, sweet, you never once in your whole life memorized a Bible story. I know some stories. Let me see. Zacchaeus was a wee little man, and a wee little man was he. He climbed up in the sycamore tree for the... You and I went to the same Sunday school. But that's a song. I learned it through a song. And then I got, how did I learn those Bible verses? And one of the first books I did with Abingdon was called Faith Quakes. And in that book I said, here we are in a digital electronic culture and we're still trying to teach the Bible with flannel graphs and chalkboards. And I wish I could take those words back. Because in my own life I got thinking, the stories that I do know, guess where I learned them from? Those flannel graph people and those chalk artists. If it hadn't been for them, I'd have a worse case of versitis than I do. So I repent of those words. We have to learn to approach the Bible whole, and life whole. The future belongs to right-brained people. The church has only half a brain, and it's the wrong half. And this right-brained world is aborning, and everything left-brained, especially the eds and meds growth areas and the economy, is being outsourced and off-peopled. It's time we rediscovered the apple. You can think of the left brain as an orange and the right brain as an apple. Now, we need both brains. I'm not arguing against that. But we've so privileged the left brain. You eat an apple whole as an organic entity. And I think our future depends on our rediscovery of an Apple approach to life without leaving behind our orangish accomplishments. In other words, we're moving from a critical to a post-critical, if you want to put it in academic language. We've taken the higher critical as far as we can take it. I have a hazing ritual for my doctoral students. I require them all the 1956 Philosophy of Science textbook by Michael Polanyi, Personal Knowledge, where he introduces this post-critical approach, where he basically argues that there is no understanding without standing under. That's my way of describing it. But let me tell you what I mean by that. There's no way of understanding anything until you first what? Stand under it. That is so not the orange. See, this is why, who were some of the worst people ever to listen to sermons? Preachers. Because the only thing that we're trained to do is what? Peel it, dissect it. We can't take it whole. We can't experience it whole. I've been trying to purge this higher critical stuff in my own spirit because I came to the point where everybody I was meeting, I was immediately sizing them up. What I like about you, what I don't like about you, I had to move to a post-critical in my own approach to people and relationships because, no, I have no business even saying anything about you. There's no understanding you until I first what? Stand under you. It's ironic to me that you have higher, these literary theorists who are taking Polanyi and are out there approaching other literature in a post-critical way have a higher authority for the scriptures than many of our biblical scholars. Because we have so sold out to this hyper, higher critical mode. Now, they'd say that about the Quran. They'd say that about J.K. Rowling. You know what I mean? There's no understanding without what? Standing under. The orange is overstanding. The apple is understanding. And with the apple comes, that's turning an apple into an orange. Don't do that. With the apple comes a word, another word, organic. You are going to be hearing so much about organic church, organic this, organic that. You're going to get sick of it. Let me give you some of the authors. Neil Cole, Joe Myers, Robert Dale, Frank Viola, Alan Hirsch, Wolfgang Simpson, Bob Roberts, all these people. There's this huge, what church growth was to the 80s and 70s and 80s, church health was to the 90s, organic church is to where we are today. Partly it's the rediscovery of the apple. They're seeing the church and encouraging us to see the church as an organic developing body within an organic changing society. This is not new. You can go back and read this in Thomas Cranmer or Richard Hooker. But these writers are giving the 21st century the conceptual tools by which to dream into being and becoming organic communities. Now, some of them disagree with one another. For somebody like Neil Cole, there is a role for institution, pastors, hierarchy. For somebody like Frank Viola, there is no role for any hierarchy or any institution. So you're going to be seeing in this whole organic church movement wide varieties of what do you do about the established institutional structures. But you're going to be hearing a lot more about this organic church and this, for me, this metaphor of the apple. Let me stop there. Comments, questions, anything about that?
What does organic mean?
It means whole. It means it's something that you grow. In other words, you treat a church less like a machine, which is what we're used to thinking of it as. Like a job description fits you in. See? It's a mechanistic model. An organic model is how do you make things fit together? Okay? You connect. And how do you grow, not so much build, but you grow it. So it's a very different model of building a church, which is a much more Gutenberg, versus growing organically. And every organic thing makes it up as it goes along. So this is very hard for our churches. They're stuck in strategic planning, all that kind of mechanistic model stuff. Organic church, it's a partnership between, you're basically giving it the right nutrients and support that it needs to grow, but you're trying to grow something. And you're not really certain how it's going to come up, and you've got to change your methodologies and your approaches depending on. Natural, I really frankly see natural church as not yet organic. I mean, it's still very, it's almost a kind of, yeah, that's a great metaphor. I'm not going to say it, but it's preparing the way for organic. It's very mechanistic about how you do organic stuff, if you will. Yeah. And many of our conferences have adopted it and are trying to institutionalize it. And for me, it's just, I mean, and I like, it's a good vestibule to something, but it's so far from where the future is headed. Yeah.
If George Barna is right, we now say there are more people worshiping in house churches than are worshiping in the United Methodist Church. Does the house church dynamic have anything, does it relate to what you're
yes, saying? It's, yes, exactly. Yeah, it happens exactly. It happens where it happens. It's a very organic. Everybody in the house church movement is in some way part of this organic church movement. Now, there are some who say house churches can exist with institutional established churches. There are others who say that they can't, that there's just no way you can. I happen to think that they can. I think it's going to be mixed. I think people are going to be part of all. Let me give you an example. This guy, he wrote a book called Lost in America. And he's a part of a parachurch organization. It's out of Boise, Idaho, but he actually lives in Des Moines. And he and I were on the plane together, Clegg. And we were talking, and I said, well, you know, how you doing, and how do you like Des Moines? And he said, oh, I love it. I said, what are you doing about your worship community and your faith community? And he said, my wife and I are involved in house churches. We started a house church movement. In fact, we started a network of house churches. We started one in our house, got so big, we started to plan another one. In 5 years, we have 18 house churches. And I said, well, you know, so you just are planting these all over the Des Moines, Iowa area? He said, yeah, the newest one was just that we have a military base here. And I said, well, do you ever see any of these people from the other house churches? So I said, oh, yeah, it's part of the agreement. Every 5 weeks, we all gather together for a kind of a Sunday afternoon, and we just come together. We either rent a place in a hotel, we get an armory or something. We just come and we have a great time together. We praise and we worship and we sing and we eat and we just have a great time. And I said, well, you know, I've always wondered this about a house church. I said, you got kids, right? Teenagers? He said, yeah. I said, well, you know, what do you do about your youth ministries? I mean, you know, our kids need to know there's more than two other Christians, you know. He goes, oh, we've taken care of that. We've got that in our budget. And I said, okay. So what do you mean your budget? He said, yeah, well, it was a really good mega church in town. They have a great youth ministry. So what we are doing is we're supporting that large church's ministry. In fact, the pastor is really smart because he's created an advisory council. He's put me on it and some other people that are part of this house church network. I said, oh, so you've outsourced your youth ministry. Now, he did not like that. Okay, that was not good news to him. But and he kind of resisted that. But then he said something really interesting. And he said, oh, by the way, I don't tell everybody this, he said, but, you know, my wife and I, we kind of sneak there sometimes to go to church too. So notice how complex things are getting. He's got a small house church. Kids go to a mega church. They also have this middle size kind of, you know, 300-400 that gathers every 5 weeks, but then they still get together at the. And I saw this is the future forming right around us. It's not either or, it's both and a lot of different and also.
We've talked about the itinerant clergy in our circles. Is there an itinerant laity?
I also call them migrant worshipers, but that's another that's another story. Yeah. Anyone else about organic and Apple? apple organic. Okay, let's do number two, real quick. See how many of these we can get through. Here's a little ditty, first heard in 1971 in a Coca-Cola commercial. I'd like to teach the... In what?
Okay.
Harmony. Now, this is kind of prophesying your way forward here, but I'm hoping that we hear it more than that word balance, because it's a better metaphor. But if you notice out there, there's a lot of talk about we got to learn how to live a balanced life. Balanced life is a Gutenberg metaphor. You got the scales of justice, what you put on one side, you got to offset and balance it on the other. Harmony is a better metaphor than balance. We have to learn how to live a more harmonious life. The future doesn't need to be more balanced, but it does need to be more harmonious. Especially a future characterized by what I call harmonious difference. In fact, you can make the case, which I do, that the two words religion and harmony mean basically the same thing. Harmony came into English from Latin via French, but its origins are Greek. In a classical Greek, harmonia was used for ideas of agreement, but its literal meaning was a fastening to keep the ship planks together, or a joint to fasten together, kept together, tied together. Harmony means to fit together. Guess what religion comes from? Religare, which means to fit together. Since all metaphor involves double exposure, the thing being described and the thing it's being compared to, metaphors are best able to bring harmony to religious dissonance. There's a Tai Chi martial art principle that says every movement in one direction begins with a subtle movement in the opposite direction. In this well-curved world that we talked about, where opposite things are happening at the same time, a non-dualist faith lives the mountaintop and the valley, the macrocosm and the microcosm simultaneously. Jesus did not live a balanced life. Did he? But he lived a harmonious life. And the role, yeah, that's exactly. This metaphor of harmony, and I'll tell you, I come out of Appalachian culture, so I know what kind of music the angels listen to. Okay, I'm not sure the angels can sing. You know, it never says in the Bible the angels sang. I think that's why God created us, humans, to sing. But it's Southern gospel music. And what I love about Southern gospel music is the tight harmony. In many ways, our faith communities used to, as we began as Methodists, have a tuning every week, a musical tuning of the souls to learn what it is to sing different notes with different words in a different beat, sometimes even on a different page, but sing the same love song to Jesus. We had a tuning in harmony, harmonious difference. When the choir marched in, the harmony marched out. Now we're all just stuck singing the melody line, so we don't have that tuning anymore. But we've got to learn to sing once again in harmony, to live together in harmony. You don't all have to be singing the same song, the same note, the same beat, the same sound, even the same words. But we can be on the same song. Now, part of this harmony is the challenge is we've got a harmonized paradox. We've got to simultaneously harmonize opposites and extremes as part of this well-curved world. And we can do that. In fact, I think that's the essence of orthodoxy. I think it was very hard to be an Orthodox Christian in the Gutenberg world. Because Gutenberg, it brought everything to a point and made that point either or. So it was either this way or that way. It was either true or false. It was either right or, for my father, it was either my way or, yeah, you got the same father. But it was a either or. In fact, that was the very definition of a falsehood. Something could not be true if it was a logical contradiction. Okay? That was the Enlightenment's definition of a falsehood. This is very different for Christian, very difficult for Christianity. See, for Jesus, the truth always comes in surround sound. In fact, if you're only hearing one thing, you're not hearing Jesus. I'm the Lion of the tribe of Judah, and I'm the Lamb of God that takes away the sins. I am Alpha and I am Omega. You give to Caesar what Caesar's, and you give to, you know, opposite sides of the same coin. Yeah. You want to be first, you got to be. You want to be greatest, you got to be. I've come that you might have life, John 10:10. Whole life, not half life, not term life. Whole life. Come and live, Jesus said. And he left it there? No, you want to follow me, you got to take up your cross and come and die. You want to be weak? My strength is made perfect in your weakness. Hey, this orthodoxy is paradoxy. It's hard. Where do you come? Oh, let me try it again. We believe, we are radical monotheists, we believe that God is one. Boy, wait a minute. We also believe God is, see, God, even God exists in relationship. What's the truth? See, in a logical mindset of enlightenment, modern, higher critical framework, truth has got to be one and a half. So God's one and a half. No. Now the truth is, you say what? Yes. Both and. We believe Jesus is fully human. We believe Jesus is fully. What's the truth? Hey, an enlightenment mindset. No, I can't. But he's not half human, half God. See? So we are now. So harmony goes with paradox, just as apple goes with organic. We got a world where paradoxical things are happening. This is our natural habitat. We ought to feel at home in this. Now, notice I'm talking about opposite things happening at the same time, and you don't try and resolve them into a middle. See, that's Hegelian. You got a thesis, you got an antithesis, and then you got a synthesis. Try and find that happy middle. That's not what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about a battery. Parker Palmer has the best metaphor for this. I can't do any better. A battery is dead unless you do what? You clean off the positive, make it as positive as you possibly can, and you connect the positive to the, and you clean off the negative so that it's as clean a connection as you possibly can. And when you got a clean connection at both extremes, you connect them and you have all the power you want to take you to wherever God's calling you to go. So a battery charge harmony. The harmonious difference of paradox, even when the paradoxes are opposites. By the way, the basic symbol of Christianity is precisely this. You got these two extremes, and you never separate them. Heresy is a cross uncrossed. When you're only hearing one thing, you're not hearing Jesus. You got to hear surround sound. You got to hear. So we got all these strengths inventories. You know what I'm talking about? What are your spiritual gifts? Let's go measure them. Let's go find out what they are. Well, I'm not opposed to that. I think it's important you know what your gifts are, what your strengths are. I mean, God gave you those strengths for a reason. God gave you those gifts for a reason. I mean, because that's where you can bless others naturally. You don't need God for those strengths. You already got them. That's one of the reasons why the church is fixated on spiritual gifts. What are our strengths? Our strengths inventories. Let's measure them. No. It's important to know what your strengths are, but that's where you're going to bless others through your own power. See, the biblical account is, yes, you know, you do have these strengths. God gave you some strengths, but remember, God's strength is made perfect where? So find me a weakness inventory. Because you want to know how you're going to bless others most supernaturally? Not naturally, but through the power of the Spirit? Tell me where your greatest weakness is. And how did we miss this? I mean, the whole story of the Bible. Moses, I want you. Okay, what do you want me to do, God? I want you to stand up to the greatest political, economic, and power of the day. And I want you to look him in the eye and say, let my people go. And Moses says, oh, that's just where I scored highest on my personal gifts inventory. You know, I am so strong here. Man, I've been waiting for you to call me all my life. Right here. Moses goes, what? No way, Yahweh. You got the wrong guy, and that's just, I got a speech defect. I can't even talk hardly. Yeah, you don't want me. This is where I'm weakest. And there is no way, Moses, for you to do it on your own power. But I will make a way. I will make a way. And we have that make a way through Jesus, who is the way. All right. Okay. Let me just stop there. Harmony, the harmonious difference of opposites, of paradox. You've got to have paradoxical skills. You've got to have skills for paradox, the ear for paradox, to hear two different things. Comments, questions? Yeah.
Doesn't our culture make it really easy, though, for that to be taken to an even further extreme where Jesus is just one truth? Hold any number of truths that just Jesus saying, I'm the best truth in my life, that's nice, that's the truth for you. And that a group culture doesn't really necessarily need to fix that paradox.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why you would be in the culture but not of the culture. Every culture I see is equidistant from eternity. And you'll have all sorts of problems that go with every single culture. And that's one of the big ones in this one, is that you can have many, many things dangling out there and they don't need to be resolved. But here's how I help my Google students deal with that, okay? Again, it's another metaphor. But it's been real helpful to me. And this is maybe telling you too much, but... There came a time when IBM, now Lenovo, but back in the IBM days when it was actually making computers in the U.S., not China, it saw these two things coming. Linux, open source. Microsoft, closed source. And it had to make a decision, which is the future. Is it going to be closed source? Microsoft guards its source code better than the U.S. guards Fort Knox. That's how it keeps it secure. Linux is a very different operating system. Its source code is open for everybody, and the only safety and security in the Linux source code is that it is so open, everybody is watching it and can play with it. But everybody's playing with it as other people are watching it. So, very different systems. So is the future, IBM said, open source or closed source? And guess what they decided? Both. So what they did is they enabled you to double boot. You can at the same time run Firefox and Windows Explorer. Now, I've double booted my faith. But here are the extremes in both. This is not a middle way. I want you to hear this. This is no middle way. This is double booting two extremes. I believe Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Not a good way, not a better way, not a very fine way, but the way, the truth, the life. I have booted a closed source operating system on my soul. Did y'all hear that? Okay. That's called Microsoft. That's called closed source. Same time. I booted an open source Linux model. You know what? Jesus can do whatever Jesus wants to do. He can appear wherever he wants to appear. And I know Jesus. I know the Jesus smell. And I tell you, I've met some people who haven't claimed to be followers of Jesus with more Jesus in them than people who all are happy, clappy, worshiping him all the time. Let me tell you, Holy Spirit can manifest Christ wherever the Holy Spirit wants. And I think the two questions in heaven are going to be, where so-and-so and what are you doing here? Do you hear what I mean? So I'm operating out of both. But it's not a middle way here. It's not a middle way. This is with all my being. I bet my whole life Jesus is the way, the truth. That's why I'm a Jesus follower. That's my identity. I'm a follower of Christ.
You still have Jesus on both sides.
I still have Jesus on both sides because let me tell you, I don't take, this is called prevenient grace. You take Jesus out there in the world? What do you mean, he didn't arrive till you got there? No. Long before you and I ever arrived, Jesus was out there. He's out there in every religious tradition. He's out there in every, but it's still Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah. And part of your job and mine is to join Jesus in what he's already up to. So, yeah, double boot. Anybody else? This harmonious. Okay, number three. Jesus expected his followers to be born of water and of the Spirit. We've got the water thing. Where's the Spirit thing? It's time to coax the Holy Spirit out of our enforced hiding in the church. It's time to experience the high flight of the Spirit. In fact, when you are living in the streams of the Spirit, you become high flyers, breathing the very breath of God. And I love that, breathe on me, breath of God. The third metaphor, Spirit, and I have a word for it. I've created this word, so I don't expect it to catch on, but I'm still enough of a wordsmith that I love words. And there's certain words, I love the form in your mouth, my mouth. Called, one of them is astronaut. Can you all say that word? Astronaut. You almost have to use all your mouth muscles to say that word, astronaut. Naut is a nautical word meaning sailor. Astro is, so an astronaut literally is a sailor of the stars. Isn't that beautiful? A cosmonaut is a sailor of the cosmos. I got thinking, I thought, you know, really what we are as disciples of Jesus, we are sailors of the Spirit. What's the Greek word for spirit? We're pneumonauts. So with spirit for me comes this word pneumonauts or pneumonautics. What does it mean that in this Gutenberg world we imbibe the heresy that it's the trees that move the wind? Is one of the greatest heresies of the modern church, the Gutenberg church, the notion that the most powerful forces in this universe are material forces. It is not the trees that move the wind. The Bible says not by might, not by power, but what? By programs. Isn't that the one? No. Not by might, not by power, not even by programs, but by the process. Just trust the process. Not by might, not by power, not by programs, not even by process, but it's by the Spirit. We have so bought in to the tree side of the equation. Einstein, in 1905, gave us a little formula, four letters, one number, E equals, basically he says E stands for what? M stands for? C stands for? Speed of light squared. Basically, what Einstein is saying with this little formula is that energy and matter are different forms of the same thing. In fact, the first one who really helped people understand this formula, it was 1929. His name was Sir Arthur Eddington. He was a Quaker physicist. And he was standing before the Royal Society of London. And he was trying to get these scientists then of his day. And he was lecturing behind a table. And he said, all right, let me try and help you understand what Einstein's saying here. What's this table made of? If you're Einstein, you got this formula, E equals MC squared. Is it energy or is it matter? What is this table made of? What's the correct answer? Of course, it's 1929, and they all said what? Matter. He said, no, you don't get it. He said, this table, let me try again. Is this spirit or is this substance? What is the fundamental reality of this table, according to Einstein? And they all said, it's 1929, they all said substance. He said, no. If you really get Einstein, the answer is both. But if I got to choose one or the other, I'm not choosing substance. I'm not choosing matter. I'm going with spirit. I'm going with energy. In fact, let me just rearrange the molecules of this table. Anybody got a match? We'll still keep it a table. We'll just get rid of all the empty space. See, one of the biggest problems that we have is to dematerialize our thinking. Because we have so left-brained it and materialized it. And we've so done church out of the MC squared side. That's the engineering side. We've become, in the worst sense of the word, tree huggers. When we should have been windsurfers, wave riders, pneumonauts. And I think you're going to be seeing a whole explosion of interest in pneumatology, the doctrine of the Holy Spirit, which, by the way, was the reason Wesley said that God raised up us. But that's how far we've come from our roots. And this whole pneumonautics, this whole openness to the Spirit, you're also seeing in the growth worldwide. The two forms of Christianity that are growing worldwide are those that are most comfortable in these kinds of windblown atmospheres. The Pentecostal movement. We've seen roughly 25%, that's the most conservative estimate, of the worldwide Christian body today to identify themselves as charismatics, Pentecostals. You didn't have one charismatic Pentecostal till 1906. This is the largest explosion of a movement in Christian history. One century, 25% of the worldwide body has become charismatic Pentecostal. The other extreme, the ones that are most open to the mystery, Eastern Orthodox, highly liturgical. Smells, bells, chants, churches that are open to the winds of the Spirit, open to the numinous, open to the unknown, not afraid of that windy part. Two extremes, but both sharing the same pneumonautic space. I think you're going to be reading and seeing more about what it means for people to live less out of the order of St. Roberts and more out of the order of St. Paul. St. Paul's rules of the Spirit. And there's openness. Okay, comments, questions. Number three, third metaphor.
If they get to a certain point, then you've got to take the vision in one of two ways, either turn it into structure or really let it free. People are afraid to, at least most of the people in the church make those kinds of decisions. They're afraid that they would be able to move back into a very linear, left-wing kind of structure.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I think it's even worse than that. Because visioning is still you're in control. So if we're even afraid of a visioning process when you're in control, then our problem is even doubled. By that I mean, in a biblical sense, you don't see a vision, you hear a vision. Faith comes by what? Hearing. You look in the scriptures over and over again. If you see a vision, chances are it's your vision and you're in control. That's why our eyes are very deceitful. God gave us eyelids for a reason. Because I have a glass of water, I put a pencil in it, and what? It looks like I got two pencils. See? You go down the highway, and you're driving down the highway, you see on the road what? Mirages all over. That's why you got to start all over. Because you got every couple seconds, you got to start all over. Because your eyes take you into the world. In a biblical sense, notice over and over again, you don't see the vision, you hear it first. Sound becomes sight. What's the first manifestation of the Spirit at Pentecost? Sound of the... And then, the tongues of fire. And God said, what? Let there be light. Sound becomes sight. When Leonard Bernstein conducted that, getting ready to celebrate his 90th birthday, even though he's not alive, but everybody's celebrating it. That's what an impact he had. When he would conduct his Genesis, his Mass, when he got to this place in the Mass where this had happened, he would stop, he'd look at the audience and say, Hebrew's wrong here. We translate and God said. The real Hebrew is, now he's making it up a little bit here, but the real Hebrew is, and God sang, let there be light. And I'll tell you those first four notes that God sang. Let there be light. Da, 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 da. Over and over again. Notice the story of the burning bush. Moses heard it before. He heard and then saw. The real issue, my favorite, Jurassic Park, did you all see that movie? Okay. My favorite image in that whole Jurassic Park series is that lawyer in the outhouse. See, y'all remember that? And there we are, Gutenberg people, reading our print. The whole world's changing outside, but we're still happy. We got our books. And see, by the time, what's the first manifestation? The T-Rex is loose, that the world really has changed. Vibrations. By the time you see it, guess what?
Too late.
You pick up, faith comes by hearing. You pick up the sound first. So yeah, we got to hear it. Then we see it, and we're still stuck even on the seeing stage, which shows you we're still. See, your ears take the world into you. You're not in control. Your eyes take you into the world. You're in control. None of you sees the same lens suite because you all are creating a whole different lens suite because your eyes are in charge. So we got a major, the primary spiritual organ. In the Middle Ages, when they showed Mary getting pregnant, the Immaculate Conception, the pregnancy was occurring through her ears. It was a ray of light from the heavens through her ears, the primary spiritual gateway, the ears. So yeah, I think it's even worse than you're saying. Yeah. Anyone else? Let's do another one. We only got another minute or so, but let me give you one. What is this, number four? I got further than I thought. Here's the last one, and the metaphor is pilgrim, and what you better watch out for is followership, not leadership. We spent 30 years with leadership, and the more the church has been obsessed with leadership, the greater its leadership crisis. The leadership paradigm is bankrupt. It's a fetish. It's a category mistake. Anyway, before you can find the word leader in the Bible, and you can make the case that you can't find it at all in the New Testament, you find other words that we translate as leader. Only a few. One is the most famous one. Everybody says, oh, that's the word leader. You look it up in the Greek, and it really is helmsmanship. How do you steer a boat through a storm? But you have to, before you find even one of those isolated, remote words, you have to hurdle hundreds of words per follower. Methetes. M-A-T-H-E-T-E-S. Follower. Disciple. The basic category of faith is not leader anyway, but follower. And it's time we learn to play a game we've stopped playing called follow the leader. Who is the leader anyways? Jesus. That's his fundamental identity. What's my fundamental identity? Follower. Even when I'm summoned to the front of the lines, I lead from behind. I lead from behind him. We have not liked our basic category, therefore we are fighting with it and trying to talk. I guarantee you, though, your conference, try and put on a conference on followership and see how many show up. Do a leadership conference. Oh, we all come. They will start coming to followership conferences for a couple reasons. One is this Wall Street thing has realized this whole leadership thing that we got from the corporate world maybe not be ours to begin with and shouldn't have been ours to begin with. The second thing is the reveal squeal. Some of the biggest news last year was the big oops by Willow Creek, the most talked about, most successful church of the last 30 years. If this is not a big story, I don't know what is. When Bilbo Hybels, I got to admire his courage, has the courage, after 30 years of raising hundreds of millions of dollars, being the most talked about, admired, I go everywhere in the world, Bill Hybels' name is a god. This church is the most imitated, modeled after church. And Bill Hybels has the courage last year to publish a book. I don't like this book at all. I mean, I admire the courage. They totally misdiagnosed their problem, however, and they got a wrong solution for it because they misdiagnosed it. But it's a whole other story. Let's give them credit. And after 30 years of being involved in this leadership paradigm, this whole leadership model, Bill Hybels has admitted that the one thing they thought they were doing, they weren't doing, and that is creating disciples. I guarantee you, this is like a tsunami. And it will eventually, the shockwaves will turn people away from this whole leadership paradigm. Even though people are still doing it. We just had Catalyst last week. Anybody there? Why wasn't anybody there? There were 13,000 people there. Were you there? Okay.
2 weeks ago, I was at the quote, Leadership Institute at Church of the Resurrection.
Yeah.
What is your take on that?
But as I said, it'll take a while for this to sink in. But I guarantee you the focus in the future is how do our churches produce better disciples of Christ? How do we become better followers? When the early church said, the earliest mantra of the church is, Jesus is Lord. Okay, what does this mean? When you went around saying, Jesus is Lord, what does that mean? I be the leader? It's time for me to learn how to be a leader? No, when you say Jesus is Lord, it means that you and I are claiming to be a follower. And we have lost this. It doesn't mean, too, Jesus is my highest value or Jesus is my core value. It means I am a follower and I am willing to follow. By the way, this is one of the things that Obama and others have understood about Googlers. They like to follow. Did you notice the categories of Twitter? That's two categories. Who are you following and who is following you? It's all about following. It has nothing about leadership. It's all about following. This need for a postmodern pilgrim's progress, as I put it. Well, we're on this pilgrimage. And the more we're on this pilgrimage, the more we understand that we are all pilgrims. We're all followers. And we're following Jesus out there into the world so that all of life then becomes a mission trip. Mission trip is not something you take. A mission trip is something you're on for your entire life. And I think this is the greatest thing, and I'm going to end here. This is the greatest thing that God's up to. Is that in the Gutenberg world, we went into this new world and we learned what it means that your baptism is your ordination into ministry. It's called the priesthood of all believers. That when you became baptized, you became a minister of the gospel. So I hate all this volunteer language. You know, Kiwanis has volunteers, Rotary has volunteers, the church has ministers. I want to leave you with an image. I'm working on a theology of football, so excuse me, but it's two parts of this game. I already alluded to it earlier. In the huddle. With me? In the huddle, there is a role for the huddle and there's a purpose for the huddle. The huddle is when you exercise your ministry to the body. And there is a time when you all get look in each other's eyes and let's rah rah and cheer cheer and do our happy clappy and have a good time figuring out, you know, let's make sure each other's needs are being taken care of and everything's okay. But the whole of life is not the huddle. And what the biggest thing God's doing today is, yes, you have a ministry to the body, but your baptism is your commissioning as a missionary. Every one of us lives a missionary life. And it's not just what's your ministry to the body, what's your mission in the world. We all were born with a ministry and a mission. We have a ministry to the body, that's in the huddle, but we have a mission in the world. And the rediscovery of this thing that we seem to have lost, that we all were made for a mission. You don't think this resonates with this culture? The John Wesley of our day made a fortune and gave it away, is giving it away. I have enormous respect for him. Because all he did was use that concept, you were made for a mission, but gave it a non-religious word. You were made for a purpose. Book's called Purpose Driven Life. Just as seeker sensitive, seeker friendly, as he would put it, way of talking about mission. And how many copies of that book? Because everybody knows down deep in life, down deep in their heart, they were made for a mission. We've got to get our churches out of that huddle because they think, most of them think that's the whole game. But in the game of football, if you spend too long in the huddle, what? You get penalized. When you get penalized, you start what? You start going the wrong way. Now, for some of our churches, this is good news because now we can go back to the good old days. We can go back to 1958 and when everything was good. No, no, no. The purpose of the game is to move down the field, to score some touchdowns in eternity for God, to move in mission and ministry. So, four metaphors that can transform the future, transform our churches. Your job, make the familiar what? You're in the strange business. It may be a strange business you're in, but you're in the strange business. Make the familiar strange. Thank you all. Thank you all very much. Thank you.